Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the FCC. My name is Florence de Changy. I'm a board correspondent in the club and a correspondent for Le Monde and the French National Radio, and I'm delighted to be your host today. Before I introduce our guest speaker, let me quickly run you through the coming up events. Tonight, we have a panel discussion, which is called Pourquoi Hong Kong? With young millionaires, French millionaires, kind of, who will explain how they made it in Hong Kong. Then next week, we have two very interesting lunches. One is with the head of IATA, the International Air Transport Association, on the 9th of March, on Monday. And then on Tuesday, we have Catherine Carnau, with an amazing photographer. So do not hesitate to join us for this. And also, please remember to turn off your phone during the presentation today. So today, it is my great pleasure to be with you to listen to one of the finest experts on China and on the cross-strait relationship. Professor Jean-Pierre Cabestan is the head of the Department of Government and International Studies at Hong Kong Baptist U. He's also associate researcher in Sciences Po Paris. He wrote extensively on China and on Taiwan. And since Taiwan is the topic of the day, I'll only mention some of the most recent ones. China-Taiwan is War Conceivable. Another one called Outside Security of Taiwan Against China's Threat. And the most recent one, published in English, is called Political Changes in Taiwan Under Meng Zhou. There is a copy here. Unfortunately, it's not available, but I'm sure good bookshop could get it for you. Anyway, there won't be any question too difficult for Jean-Pierre. As those of you who are familiar with Taiwan would have noticed, Taiwan is generally underreported in the news, maybe not so much in Hong Kong, but overall. But there have been very interesting events that have taken place there the last year, mainly, of course, the Sunflower Movement, a year ago almost to the day. And last November, this landslide victory for the DPP and also the apparition of an independent man who won Taipei City. And then just yesterday, President Xi Jinping, who was calling for high vigilance against advocates of independence for the island. So all these fascinating developments that Jean-Pierre Cabestan is going to tell us more about. So please welcome Professor Jean-Pierre Cabestan. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to be back to the FCC after so many years. Thank you, Florence, for this very nice introduction, and thank you for inviting me. And what you were saying in introducing one of my books regarding China-Taiwan relations, published in 2004, title, Is a War Conceivable? Looks like antics today, as we have witnessed since 2008, unprecedented rapprochement between Beijing and Taipei, and which is under, as you know, the Kuomintang rule now. I think one of the last times I was at the FCC, it was a long time ago, in 1999, at the time of a kind of mini crisis across the Taiwan Strait after Li Donghui, the president of Taiwan at the time, made public a statement indicating that relations across the Taiwan Strait were quasi state-to-state relations. I don't know if you remember that. And of course, that triggered some tension between both sides and also to some degree between Taiwan and the US. So you already at the time, you had all the ingredients of what I'm still tended to call a strategic triangle between Taipei, Beijing, and Washington, although it's a very asymmetrical one. Now, the title of this talk is What is Taiwan's Future Political Landscape? I think to understand what's going to happen in the coming month and maybe coming years, we have to look back at last year in 2014, where a number of, again, unprecedented developments took place, both in Taiwan and Hong Kong, and I think there's been some relationship between the two events. As you know, next year there will be a legislative and presidential election, so Ma Ying-jeou is going to step down because he cannot run for a third term. And the date of the election has been more or less decided. Both elections are going to take place on the same day in January 2016. And so in the new landscape, the chances for the opposition party, Democratic Progressive Party, independence-leaning grouping, now chaired by Mrs. Tsai Ing-wen, its chances to come back to power have increased. Now, it's not a done deal, and we'll explain why. It's still the, I think, competition is still wide open. But the political landscape changed at the end of last year with local elections, Florence mentioned, which allowed the DPP to win quite a number of seats in the cities and counties of the island. Now, I think we have to first of all go back to the Sunflower Movement and say a few things about the Sunflower Movement, which took place in the spring of last year. I think it's the major objective of the Sunflower Movement was to kind of break up the black box of cross-strait relations, of cross-strait negotiations. And there was a growing feeling last year in Taiwan, in the civil society, that the Kuomintang and the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, were negotiating over the head of the Taiwanese society a number of deals, agreements, which were supposed to be beneficial to the island, but which many people didn't see actually the benefit for themselves. And in addition to that, there was a feeling that not only the society, but also the opposition in the parliament were not involved or not consulted regarding the agreements and the negotiations taking place between both sides. Now, what triggered the Sunflower Movement, just to make it short, was a cross-strait service agreement, which had been signed the year before in June 2013 by both sides' negotiators, so the SAF on the Taiwanese side and the ARATS on the Chinese side, which was to be approved and endorsed by the parliament, by the Li Fa Yuan, by the Taiwanese legislative yuan. And the KMT sped up the procedure and decided after 90 days of discussions and debates about this agreement, a vote should take place. And of course, that triggered an opposition with the DPP. But the DPP, on the whole, was not very active. And what was unprecedented, in my view, was the fact that the civil society, a number of activist groups, went on the stage and launched this Sunflower Movement, which, in the first place, led to the occupation of the Legislative Yuan, an occupation which had been helped to some degree by some DPP legislators, but which was not triggered whatsoever by the DPP itself. So what happened in the spring last year, between the March and April, was the emergence on the Taiwanese political stage of new forces coming from the civil society, a number of civic groups, a number of new leaders. I mean, remember maybe some of those leaders, people like Lin Fei Lan or Chen Weiting and others, people we had never heard of before, at least outside of Taiwan. And making inroads on the political stage. Now, one of the reasons, there are a number of reasons why the movement sort of, first of all, remained on the whole rather peaceful, except for one exception when some of the activists wanted to take control of the seat of the government, the executive yuan. But apart from that, I think the mainstream of the movement was pretty peaceful, and so one of the reasons it was peaceful, I think, it was the fact that the KMT was itself divided, and that Wang Jingping, the Speaker of the Parliament, decided to prevent the police from trying to regain control of the Parliament by force. And as a result, I think some negotiation took place, and eventually there was, with the help of Wang Jinping being a mediator between the government controlled by Ma Ying-jeou, President Ma Ying-jeou, but also his prime minister, Zhang Yihua, and the demonstrators, ending up in a deal which would suspend the endorsement of the cross-trade service agreement until a new law enhancing the supervision role of the legislative yuan in cross-trade relations is drafted and enacted. Now, this new law has not been yet approved. There are a number of drafts circulating around, maybe more than 10, I think, today. And it will take time for this new supervision law, cross-trade relations supervision law, to be approved. I don't see it being approved before, I think, the end of my Ying-jeou term, but maybe things may change. Now, this movement had a number of consequences for Taiwan, for the state-society relationship. I don't want to spend too much time on that, but I think it has also some consequences for the political parties and the local elections, which took place later that year. Now, I think before I move to this election, what I would like to add to the sort of social economic environment, which sort of also contributed to the emergence of the sunflower movement, was the fact that there's been a growing perception in Taiwan, at least in most segment, large segment of society, that cross-strait relations was not benefiting to them. That actually it had, as you may know, salaries, wages in Taiwan have been stagnating for more than 20 years. And if the rapprochement between both sides has contributed to something, it's to the growing social divide in the island, growing social inequalities, something the Taiwanese society has not been used to as much as Hong Kong society, I would say, under the Kuomintang, or even under the martial law. There were less inequality, social inequality at the time, particularly after Taiwan started to take off in the 60s and 70s and any other parts of China. So I think there was a growing social discontent and again, a frustration regarding the impact of the rapprochement policy designed and implemented by Ma Ying-jeou. Now, the elections themselves, I'm sure you followed them, were quite interesting because it gave, I think, the occasion for the DPP to come back to power a number of localities. First of all, the DPP made more votes than the KMT, clearly. It's 47% against 40%. So that's if you see the balance of power between the two major parties has, turned upside down now. And now the DPP is controlling a number of big cities, and including in the north and the center of the island. So if you're interested in that, I can come back to that later. But what is interesting is that from 15 mayors and magistrate positions controlled by the KMT before the election, the KMT lost 9 to keep 6 of them, while the DPP won 6, so 13 against 7 before. A number of independent candidates won the election, and the most, prominent one that I think you mentioned, his name, Kuwenzhe, in Taipei City. And it's an interesting case because Kuwenzhe is someone coming from the civil society, is not, he was supported by the DPP, but he's not close to the DPP, wants to go beyond the unification, independence divide. And he has been able to win against a heavyweight of the KMT, Lian Shangwen, Lian Zhan's own son, in the Taipei election with a pretty good score. So I think it showed that in cities like Taipei, which is on the whole a pretty blue city, I would say, so more Kuomintang than DPP, and for the DPP it's very hard to win in Taipei City without having a three-way election. That's what happened in 1998 when Chen Hui-min won the election. but today, that, I mean, in 2014, that wasn't the case. That's why I think Kawenja had better chance to win the election than any other DPP supported or DPP candidate. Now, what is interesting also, I mean, I don't want to go too much into the details of this election, but there's been a number of changes which are ought to be, I think, mentioned. First of all, the DPP has been able to win a number of constituencies in the north of the island. As you know, the usual divide or traditional divide in Taiwan is the north is blue, the south is green. It's not the case anymore. And one of the most significant victories was Lin Jialong's victory in Taichung City against Hu Zicheng, who is a heavyweight and old member of the KMT, who had I think he was in charge of the Taichung for quite a long time. But also, I think victories in Taoyuan and Qilong and elsewhere. Now, the major victory or kind of victory in the north among the special municipalities, and then the only one for the KMT is New Taipei City, which is Xinpei Shi in Chinese. It's the ex Taipei County, which now has been renamed New Taipei City. And the winner is Eric Chu, Zhu Lilun, and the new president of the KMT now. Now, Zhu Lilun's victory was not without a fight and was not without, actually wasn't that clear. He won with 50.06 of the vote against, I think a heavyweight of the DPP, Yu Si-kun. And so until the last, until pretty late in the evening, we didn't know whether he will make it. He made it. He's one of the, possible candidates for the presidential election next year, although now he's the mayor of New Taipei City, so if he doesn't want to resign, if he said he will not resign, he should not run for the election, but things may change in the coming month. Now, so this election was quite interesting because on the whole, the DPP, which was not a major actor, at least in the beginning of the Sunflower Movement, managed to sort of come back to the heart of the political debate and win this election. But one of the other interesting manifestations of this election is the fact that the third, fourth candidates, in particular Kawenja, made some successful scores. Now, today, since this election took place, of course, there's been a lot of speculation in Taiwan about the future of the KMT and also by as a consequence, cross-strait relations and the chances of DPP to come back to power. Now, there are a number of things we need to say regarding the coming elections, because both sides have a number of weaknesses. And if you take, first of all, the example of Tsai Ing-wen, who is the head of the chairwoman of the Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, she is a charismatic woman, she's a charismatic leader, but she's an outsider in the DPP. She doesn't have a strong political base in the DPP. She's been re-elected chairwoman of the DPP, I would say, by default, because no other candidate could really make a difference and help the DPP stay together and win the next election. Now, the question for her is to, first of all, to keep the DPP behind her, and in addition to win the presidency, to win as more seats in the parliament. And that's one of the big risks for the DPP, is that, if she's elected president in January next year, we're going to have a divided government with the legislative yuan still controlled by the KMT. And that's what happened from 2000 to 2008. That didn't help Chen Shui-bian whatsoever, as you remember. And that may sort of convince a number of voters in Taiwan to think twice before voting for her next year. So that's something we have to bear in mind. Now, a third factor, of course, is how she's, and that's going to be a very important considerations both for her, but also for the US and for China, is how is she going to deal with China? How is she going to keep the cross-strait relations stable and moving forward? As you know, the DPP has never endorsed what China and the KMT call the 92 consensus, according to which there is one China, but this thing of different interpretations, or China doesn't get into the in the definition of one China. But these so-called 92 consensus has never been endorsed by the DPP, which thinks that Taiwan equals the ROC, so they are Taiwan is not part of China, period. So now the question is, I don't think she's going to change her mind, because and the DPP is going to change its platform regarding relations with China. But at the same time, I don't think they will rock the boat too much, because they want to make sure that the US will remain on its side. And what the DPP and Taiwan have been doing since the December last year, they've tried to reach out, even before that actually, they've tried to reach out the US administration, the Obama administration, to make sure that this time they will not make any statement that will, as in 2012, which will sort of sabotage the Taiwan's candidacy and Taiwan's chances to get elected. Now they have to do more in terms of security and how much, you know, and in terms of how much the DPP is ready to invest in Taiwan's defense, and while keeping relations with China stable. Now a number of questions have to do with the agreements and 20-something agreements signed between China and Taiwan in the last 8 years by the Ma Ying-jeou administration, including the ECFA, which at the time when it was passed in 2010 was very heavily criticized by the DPP. But I don't see the DPP really deeply revising at least all those agreements. I think most of them will remain intact. That's my own take. The DPP has said that it will, I think, revise some aspect of the ECFA or the other agreements, but most of them are technical, and I don't see, for instance, if you take one basic example, the DPP putting an end or questioning the agreements which allow the flight links between China and Taiwan. I think Taiwan is benefiting from it, and I don't see the DPP really putting an end to these direct links between China and Taiwan. Now, so there are a number of questions, but on the whole, I think she was going to be very careful and won't question most of these agreements. Now, of course, there are other issues like the service agreement, and on that, I think the DPP is not against it, but will like to revise some of aspects of this agreement. Now, on the KMT side, it's a very strange situation, because you have a very kind of lame duck president, Ma Ying-jeou, who's been, as you know, he's according to opinion polls, his popularity is very low. He has regained a bit, but not very much. The KMT is divided now, clearly, since Ma Ying-jeou ceded the presidency, the chairmanship to Eric Zhu Lilun. Now, Zhu Lilun, as you know, is trying to, which is, from a political point of view, pretty sensible, take his distance from Ma Ying-jeou and trying to show that he will put together another platform and trying also to mend the KMT's relationship with the what I would call the local factions of the Taiwanese factions of the KMT, including, of course, Speaker Wang Qingping. As you know, he decided a few days ago, I think, to not to continue the to put an end to the legal dispute between the KMT and Wang Qingping. Ma Ying-jeou wanted to expel Wang Qingping from the party, but there is a law in Taiwan which allows any member to go to court to question such a decision, which in other countries would be a private decision, but it's not the case in Taiwan, because the KMT is a public organization. And now Wang Qingping was, supported by legal decisions, by court decision on two occasions, in first instance and in appeal. And Eric Zhu Lilun decided to not to appeal again, or not to question that decision. So it means that Wang Qingping will stay in the party, and that Eric Zhu will work with him and try to, I think, put together a new platform which will allow him to, hopefully for him and the KMT, win the election next year. I don't think we have to dismiss his candidacy. I don't think we have to take him very seriously. He's a popular politician in Taiwan. because of his family connections, and he can win a number of green votes or light green votes, and so it's not a done deal for Tsai Ing-wen. Now, finally, we'll see. We still have a year to go, and again, well, I'm sort of preempting the fact that forecasting that he will run. For the time being, he's not an official candidate. The candidates are, well, among the possible candidates, you have Vice President Wu Tuyi, but I don't see him really having a chance. And other candidates may come out, but again, he seems to be the only potential candidate able to save the KMT from being forced to opposition. Now, he may calculate, if he sees his chances being too weak, he may calculate that it's better to wait until 2020 before running for presidency and let Tsai Ing-wen being president for one term and then coming back to power. I mean, if you're a politician, you have to make that kind of calculation. He's a smart guy, and he may eventually decide that. But we'll see. I mean, my hunch is he will run, but there are a number of course arguments for the time being, to suppose that he won't. Now, finally, because I think we have to have to conclude, I'm being a bit too long. I think there are a number of things that we'd like to say regarding the role of the U.S. And the place of Taiwan in U.S.-China relations. I think the Obama administration. I think the last thing the Obama administration is to see the Taiwan being added up to the list of frictions of difficulties with China. It's still a problem for China, of course. Arms sales to Taiwan, by the U.S. arms sales to Taiwan are still a problem. As you know, what is quite ironic is the fact that China, since 2008, has heavily criticized the Obama administration every time it decided to sell military equipment to Taiwan, but never ever criticized Ma Ying-jeou for buying them. Which is quite an ironic situation, but that's part of the game. And now, clearly, the U.S. is aware of the fact that the KMT administration and Ma Ying-jeou has reached what I mentioned in the summary, a kind of plateau, and is not willing to go beyond that. Is not willing to start political talks with China, because he sees that those political talks as too costly from a political point of view, both for him and for the KMT. And the only issues on which he will be ready to move forward as technical agreements like the service agreement and other kinds of agreements. Now, there was another example which was quite interesting. Recently, Jack Ma, who started develop activities in Taiwan with the company he had registered in Singapore, had to sort of change and abide by the law, since his Alibaba is a Chinese company. And clearly, on that issue, the KMT itself is very cautious and is not, I think, ready or in a mood to open up the Taiwanese economy to all sort of Chinese investment. I think there are limits. If you look at the official figures, which are not very trustworthy, I think it's around $1 billion U.S. Dollars of overall investment from China in Taiwan. So it's minuscule, I would say. It's nothing. It may be higher, but still, I see in the KMT and even more in the DPP a willingness to try to control or limit at least Chinese investment in Taiwan. So I think there's been a number of areas where Taiwan have benefited, and I should mention the tourist industry, which has in 2013, the tourism has benefited a lot to Taiwan in $13 billion U.S. I think, and but at the same time, there is a feeling that they should not increase the quota of Chinese visitors coming to Taiwan. I mean, it's already 2 to 3 million a year, and that's the kind of limit they want to keep for the time being. And Jiang Yihua himself decided not to increase the quota because of the negative reactions in the society. So. Now there are some concerns, and we can maybe talk more about that in the Q&A, is that the growing influence of Chinese of China in Taiwan, including the among, in the media, in the business community, which is of course more and more dependent upon China for making money, and that already had an impact in 2012 in the election when you saw a number of green, well, so-called green entrepreneurs like the Evergreen chairman clearly supporting Ma Ying-jeou. So it's for Taiwan, it's going to be hard to try to sort of neutralize or reassure those business people in order to win the election. But clearly the society and the voters last year have shown that there is a potential for the DPP to come to power. So the game is open, but I think we're going to see a new Taiwan next year. Thank you for your attention.
Well, it's time for questions, if you have any. Francis and I always have many, so yes, please, Mr. Chin.
Thank you. Jean-Pierre, when Hu Jintao was president, he adopted a cross-strait policy that was pretty moderate. Now that Xi Jinping is in office, do you think that he will continue Hu's policies, or will Xi's policies be significantly different?
That's a good question. Thank you, Frank. So far, well, I don't think that the basic policy decided by Hu Jintao in the mid-2000 and really hammered out in 2007, which is to accept the status quo. Of course, it's one China, it's and the United States consensus, but contrary to his predecessor, Jiang Zemin, there is no more, there was at least under Hu Jintao, no willingness to speed up reunification. Now, we've seen a change of tone since 2012, I think, 2011, 2012, including, I mean, at the end of the Hu Jintao's era, in trying to remind everyone that unification remains an objective for China. And what Florence quoted before my talk regarding, which indicates that Xi Jinping clearly would like to prevent pro-independent forces to gain from gaining too much influence in Taiwan is also indicative of that concern. Now, so far, I don't see that Xi Jinping wanting to speed up unification, but I think a strong willingness in his administration to rein in and to contain pro-independence forces, and of course it's linked to the situation in Hong Kong. When you mention pro-independence forces, it means also forces which are not ready to cooperate the way China would like to see them cooperating with China. So yes, I think the pressure may increase. Now, at the same time, if you in among experts in China, there's already a sense that if Tsai Ing-wen is elected, that won't be the end of the world. It will be easier, actually, not as hard, I would say, to deal with Tsai Ing-wen than with Chen Shui-bian. Chen Shui-bian, they had a rough ride to some degree, and with Tsai Ing-wen, they're less anxious, at least among experts. They see a sense that, well, that could be acceptable. Of course, they will have to put pressure. They could pressure on the Taiwan administration, but that's they can deal with them. And as we know, the DPP, they already had a number of contact with the DPP officials and leaders in the last few years. So at least there is more communication between both sides, between the DPP and the Beijing authorities than before. So that may help as well. So.
Can I just squeeze in a small follow-up question on this? How much of Chen Shui-bian is a liability now to DPP for Tsai Ing-wen?
Well, people in Taiwan may disagree with me, but I think he's out for good. I don't think he will make a comeback. But I may be wrong. You never know in politics. You know, as long as you're alive, and he may be willing. But I think to answer your question, I think he's a liability in Tsai Ing-wen. She made a number of very clear statements when he was prosecuted and he went to sentenced to jail in 2008. And of course, it was not to the liking of everyone in the DPP. As you know, some people wanted to protect him, and the people like Yoshikun are closer to him, for instance. But on the whole, I think Tsai Ing-wen is very much aware of the fact that he's a liability, and it's better to keep some distance from him.
Okay, great. Another question, please. Could you identify yourself before asking a question?
Zach Coleman with Nikkei Asian Review. You spoke earlier about the Sunflower Movement. Did you feel that it had an influence as a political force in the last election last year, and looking toward the toward next year's elections, what will it mean?
Okay. Well, yeah, thank you for this question, because I didn't have much time to deal with that in my presentation. And here there is some kind of irony or paradox. The fact that, well, it's one thing to be a civic organization, to be an activist and organizing kind of a movement like the Sunflower Movement or a big demonstration, or the one which took place in late March, 500,000 people in front of the presidential palace. It's another thing to turn those leaders, for those leaders to turn into politicians, professional politicians. Some of them tried to set up parties, political parties, but most of them have been very reluctant to get involved in election politics. So that gave the way, actually, to the DPP to come back and to actually capitalize on the anti-KMT resentment in society in November last year. So we'll see. I mean, next year, so I've heard that some of them would like to run for election in the legislative yuan next year, yes, in January next year. But I don't think they will be able to sort of constitute a real third force at a national level. Kowenja is a good example, it's a very interesting example, but Taipei is a special place. Again, it's a special city. And there's been a number of independent candidates trying to run in other places, but they haven't been successful, I have to say. And so the way the election system is organized, you know, one seat constituencies, now since 2005, is not going to benefit a third force. So there is a space, because people are fed, so a number of voters are fed up with these kind of blue-green divide, which is sometimes very caricatural, and in the media is getting nowhere. I mean, people are sort of fed up with watching TV and having blue people fighting against green people and no independent votes being, you know, heard. But again, it's very hard to become a professional politician. I don't see many of them being seduced by that perspective. They prefer to remain in the public sphere, as I would say, in the civic movement, and remaining activists rather than politicians. I would say most of them.
Yes, we have a question there. Paul, and then yes.
Could you characterize the political and economic relevance of the investments from Taiwanese in China, but also the labor force, the demographics, the people, the Taiwanese who are in China, which is, I think, a very significant part of the population?
Well, I didn't mention that because that's the obvious, but I mean, and it's been going on for many years, but you're right. I mean, it's a very important factor in the election or even for Taiwan's future. We don't know how many Taiwanese live in the mainland, maybe 1, maybe 2 million Taiwanese. Now, most of them being rather moderate. I mean, I would say, according to estimations, maybe two-thirds of them would vote blue and just one-third green. What is interesting is that this growing, even economic integration with China has not prevented the Taiwanese identity from sort of asserting itself. Now, if you look at the latest opinion polls, last year, 57% of the Taiwanese feel they're only Taiwanese, and only 36% think they're both Taiwanese and Chinese. People who think, who identify themselves as Chinese in Taiwan is minimal, it's less than 3%, now it's 3%. So clearly the identity is still gaining, Taiwanese identity, a bit like in Hong Kong in a way, is gaining traction. Well, as in a number of areas in the world, if globalization has the opposite effect, which is to trigger more identical reactions and to strengthen the local identity. So now the big influence, of course, will be on the business community and how the business community and how the DPP is going to deal with the business community if he wants to be to come back to power. And if it's elected, how you will deal with the business community in the future. And that's now long-term trends, which for the DPP are hard to sort of not face and deal with, which is, on the whole, I think, accept to be, adopt a more accommodating policy towards China without changing its principles. So that's a fine line. That's politics.
And then, Martin, don't forget to introduce yourself, please.
I'm Martin Mertz. The mayorship of Taipei has been traditionally a stepping stone for the big political parties, for people to show their mettle and prove that they can go on to bigger and better things. So does Ko have higher ambitions as an independent to go to the presidency eventually? And if he's independent, why on earth did he hire James Song as a consultant?
Well, to demonstrate he's independent. And that's the easy one, in a sense. Yes, I mean, well, I wouldn't have done that, but, you know, he's not a professional politician. He feels, you know, kind of the atmosphere in Taipei. As I was saying, Taipei is a very blue city. You have a district where dark blue in Taipei City, Wenshan, and other districts of Taipei are pretty. So for him to be a Taipei mayor, he has to take into account all these constituencies. Now, I don't think he's a national, kind of national level politician. I don't think he has this ambition, at least for the time being. And I think he's an exception. But there's been a number of exceptions at the local level, including Taipei City. If you go back to the 60s, you had a mayor who was opposed to Chiang Kai-shek at the time, who got elected in 1964. So, I mean, that's. Again, I think the game, political game at national level, may remain pretty much controlled by both, I mean, major parties, the KMT and the DPP, the way I see it.
Great. We may have time for one more question if, Francis then. Yeah, of course.
Thanks. I had to sneak one in. Thank you, Francis Moriarty, on the board here, freelancer. You mentioned before the divide economically that's widened in Taipei. My question is actually about Hong Kong as well, but I want to try to pull this in. We've seen this divide when people voted against the DPP in favor of Ma, many people complained about the economy. Mm. It wasn't ideological, it was we're suffering. And maybe these ties will help us. What's happened instead is that there hasn't been any great improvement for people at a lower economic level. And they're unhappy. So when the Sunflower Movement came, we've seen the effect of the Sunflower Movement on Hong Kong. Yep. My question then becomes, what's the effect of Hong Kong and events here on Taiwan? And in terms of the response from China, should we expect them to become even more involved? In fact, is their resistance to any changes on elections here part of saying we're going to stop it in Hong Kong before it goes back across the straits to Taiwan and it just all begins spinning out of control?
No, actually, I believe that the umbrella movement in Hong Kong has also contributed to the DPP landslide victory in November. Maybe it's not a major factor, but I think it sort of confirmed the Taiwanese that they better be cautious with China. In any event, the one country two system formula is not something you're going to buy. Well, they never bought it, actually, but I don't think even less now. Now, as you know, there's been some kind of cross-fertilization between the Sunflower Movement and the Umbrella Movement. I'm sure you observed that very carefully here in Hong Kong, so I won't need to go into details. But I think in the longer run, in Taiwan, there's been a growing interest for what's going on here, but at the same time, a conviction that the Hong Kong experience is not something which will bring them closer to China. So I think it will help them being more careful in dealing with China, including within the KMT, I would say. who, when they were, the KMT came back to power in 2008, there were a number of people who were very optimistic about the political changes that could occur in China. And I think today, with Xi Jinping's in power and the very conservative drive he's imposing on the party, on the country, I think it has an impact on cross relations, and it has set new limits to any kind of rapprochement between China and Taiwan. So again, Taiwan is democratic and wants to remain democratic, and that's unify the Taiwanese. And any danger, anything which would jeopardize Taiwan's democracy is going to be perceived as dangerous and should be contained in Taiwan. So I think that's a kind of mainstream view and shared by both political parties, kind of bipartisan view, I would say, in Taiwan today. So again, both sides are sort of agree upon being more cautious with China, and that they should maybe, and that's something maybe you wanted to ask me regarding the U.S., they should maybe get closer to the U.S. And also capitalize on the fact that the U.S. policy of rebalancing may help them keeping their distance from China.
Great. Well, thank you very much. As you know, we make a point of trying to finish on time, so I just have time to thank you all for joining us for this lunch and for your good question, and to Professor Jean-Pierre Gavestan for joining us, and also to congratulate him on his beautiful FCC tie, but we have a new style now. This one is a bit out of style, and we have a new style to thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much.